right now. And so you have capital flight, you have accelerating brain drain, which was there before. I mean, this is the thing. Yeah. All of these trends were visible before October 7th. What October 7th has done is accelerated them to light speed. And just think about it. We talked, of course, remember a few weeks ago about Intel pulling out of a $25 billion investment in Israel. So I think this is, again, another sign in the sort of loss of confidence and the collapse in the Israeli economy. Recalling, of course, that the high-tech sector, which was over, I mean, was a high-tech sector in Israel, mostly tied to the military and to Unit 8200, which we just talked about. It was overhyped, but it was there. And it was always sort of the jewel in the crown for Israel. And also the thing that they bragged about most in their propaganda with the phrase startup nation. Oh, you know, look at Israel. It's this jewel amid this sea of barbarity, and we have this high-tech sector, and we're solving all these problems. Well, all that has evaporated.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very satisfying to see the startup nation becoming so-called, becoming a shutdown nation. And it reminds me as well of our conversations we've had in the past with the Canadian researcher, Michael Bukeret, because he wrote and researched a lot about parallels between South African apartheid and Israeli apartheid. And the South African white supremacist regime used to sort of try and justify itself in the West with these similar kind of justifications, right? Anti-communism was one, but also they tried to say that they were bringing sort of civilization, quote unquote, to Africa in a similar sort of way that Israel claims to be bringing civilization to the West Asia, as if like having some sort of app like Waze or whatever stuff they come up with would justify all their crimes and all the genocide that they're carrying out. But it's very satisfying to see that it's even that is overblown nonsense. And it's always been overblown. I remember, Ali, you writing about it in one of your books about the sort of claims about green technology and so forth. All the things they've claimed to have invented are often overhyped.
Marketing. Yeah. Marketing or failures.
Well, there is also another interesting piece, again in Haaretz, the Tel Aviv Daily. This one was an op-ed by Major General Yitzhak Brick, talking about how Israel, he estimates, has 1 year left if this war continues, especially if it expands. But more on this, the strategy of attrition. Ali. You read it. I know, John, you read it too. Yeah. What do people think about this one?
Yeah, let's just, we should also share a couple of paragraphs from this because it's so striking. So again, this is actually sort of an op-ed by Major General Yitzhak Brick, who is a reserve general, a well-known figure in Israel. And he says that most of the pretentious declarations made by Defense Minister Yoav Gallant throughout the war in Gaza have proven to be groundless. After the occupation of Gaza City, he said that Israel was in total control of the city and its tunnels, and within a short time, Hamas would surrender. After the occupation of Khan Yunis, he claimed that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar was running in the tunnels by himself and had lost control of his men, and within a few days, he would be caught. With these pronouncements, Gallant, along with his colleague, IDF Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has been throwing dust in the eyes of the Israeli public. So that's one excerpt I wanted to share, where he's just completely dismissing their claims of any military success. But then he links it to what's happening within Israeli society. And so these paragraphs are really telling. He says, Israel is sinking deeper into the Gazan mud, losing more and more soldiers as they get killed or wounded, without any chance of achieving the war's main goal, bringing down Hamas. The country really is galloping towards the edge of an abyss. If the war of attrition against Hamas and Hezbollah continues, Israel will collapse within no more than a year. Terror attacks are intensifying in the West Bank and inside the country. The reservist army is voting with its feet following recurring mobilizations of combat soldiers, and the economy is crashing. Israel has also become a pariah state, prompting economic boycotts and an embargo on arms shipments. And yeah, and just again, Yitzhak Brake is a major general in the, or was a major general in the Armored Corps, and was the commander of the IDF military colleges. So this is a very senior general who is making these prognostications.
Yeah, he's not like an anti-Zion, you know, like he's not a peaceful anti-war guy.
No, he was, his role as military ombudsman for the IDF was to deal with preparedness. So he dealt with military preparedness for a decade, and he boasts about how, in other interviews, about how $1 billion was spent on his research. He's researched 1,600 fighting units, and just so this preparedness thing isn't coming from, he's been saying this for a long time that they're not prepared. But yeah, he's not a bleeding heart. His goal for the war on Gaza was to delay the ground invasion, to continue to starve the population, cut them off. That was his strategy for Gaza. And he's worried, the things that he's worried about in the West Bank are interesting, because he's worried about the West Bank taking up a strategy like Gaza did during the Second Intifada, where the fighters with all these IEDs, that they decide to turn from defending their villages with the IEDs to turn them on the settlements and make the settlements require significant security forces to protect them. And that they just don't have in their society the ability to raise that many troops. And he's very down on the ability to fight a war with Hezbollah in any form at all. And also to his resume, he was the commander, the Northern Commander, the Northern Command Chief. So he spent a decade doing that as well. So he knows the North, he knows the fight with Hezbollah. He knows the social dysfunction within his state. He knows that they're a pariah state around the world. And a war of attrition is going to exacerbate all of those aspects.
Yeah, he. I mean, he's part of the security establishment, right? He's part of the security intelligence establishment as opposed to the Netanyahu political establishment, which, and the former is, you know, surprisingly fairly often against the latter. And we've been, I found this article interesting because we've been seeing a series of similar predictions for a while now, right? And it's again, it reminds me of another thing in one of your books, Ali, like you wrote many years ago about how people didn't expect the collapse of South African apartheid to come as quickly as it did. And when it did happen, it happened very, very quickly. You know, people, the architects of apartheid probably thought it would last forever. But when these things accelerate, it can come very quickly. And this is, you know, what we're going to see, I think. I can't say if it's going to be, you know, today, tomorrow, or whenever. But when the collapse happens, I think it will happen very quickly. And again, this is something that Israeli planners have been saying for a long time. Again, going back to the Reut Institute, 15 years ago or more, they were saying in their PowerPoint, this Israeli think tank, influential Israeli think tank, talking about the collapse of Israel's alleged legitimacy in the international arena. They were explicitly comparing themselves to South Africa at the time, saying, well, if we don't shore up our legitimacy in international fora, we could collapse sooner than we think. So these are not unrealistic assessments by any stretch.
Yeah,
those are really good points, Asa. And the what strikes me is that you know, we've heard Ilan Pappé say something similar. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says something similar. We say something similar. And here's General Yitzhak Brick saying something similar. But none of us have dared to be as, he wouldn't put it this way, I would. None of us have dared to be as optimistic as Yitzhak Brick. Even Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says, yeah, you know, Israel, it's going to collapse. But he says, I don't say it's going to be in 5 years or 10 years or, you know, he says this is its fate. That's the direction it's going. But we have to be patient. To have a senior Israeli general saying, look, we've got a year. I mean, that may be hyperbole because he's trying to shock Israeli society out of what he sees as its complacency. But on the other hand, to say such a thing when you're, you know, Israel is a country is not exactly like a bank. You know, if we think about a bank run, when rumors go out that, oh, this bank is a bit dodgy and it might fail, everyone runs to pull out their deposits and the bank fails. A country is more complicated than a bank because people live there, their lives are there and so on. But, you know, Israel is, there is a similar loss of confidence going on. And that type of loss of confidence can reach a point where it's unstoppable, where if you think about the tech workers now, for example, who wouldn't be trying to get out of Israel, get a job in the EU or in the United States or in Canada or somewhere else? If you look at how often flights to Israel are canceled and for how long, all the major airlines are canceling flights into September now. And so if you're in Israel and you're thinking, well, I want to get out of here, maybe I won't be able to because you can't go by land. Where are you going to go? You can't go north to Lebanon. You're not going to go to Jordan. I mean, there are some people in Jordan who might welcome you, but not the majority of the population. You can't, you know, you're not going to go through to Sinai. The only escape is by air. So when you start to see that even the air links, which you've taken for granted that, oh, you can just jump on a plane from Tel Aviv to anywhere in the world, when that is no longer true, and you might have to wait weeks to get a flight, or flights may be canceled or booked up months into the future, then that collapse may accelerate.
You just listened to a segment that details this latest article by the Israeli general that is predicting that Israel will basically collapse internally within a year. It's a remarkable prediction. One that I wouldn't even dare to make, but this is an expert, this is a military ombudsman that made it. And next, we're gonna hear an interview with Pepe Escobar, whereby he talks about, he's a political analyst who recently wrote an article that details how the BRICS nations are aligning themselves with Iran and with the axis of resistance in general. For those of you who don't know, are not familiar with the BRICS nations, it started out as Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Since then, it has expanded to many Arab countries. And actually, at the next BRICS meeting, which I believe will happen in Brazil, Palestine will be the guest there. And this is a piece of news, a piece of information, I guess, that you're not going to hear about because It's really about the fact that our world is becoming bipolar instead of, or rather not bipolar because of its the connotations, but multipolar rather than unipolar. And we have a situation on one side where the US has bombed and sanctioned itself into a box while the BRICS nations have been expanding their reach, especially China, economically. So extending an economic hand. And of course, this is not as, you know, out of goodwill, but out of the fact that they know it's a strategically sound way to do business, so to speak, rather than sanction and bomb and massacre people as the United States has done since World War II. So let's have a listen to the interview with Pepe Escobar about Putin, China, and Iran, and what's happening in terms of Palestine.
You have just written a really, I think, important article in The Cradle about how three BRICS countries, we're talking about Russia, China, and Iran, have been coordinating, navigating, dealing, and wheeling around what has transpired over the last several months, especially Israel's incredibly dangerous aggression in Lebanon, in Iran, which has left the entire collective West kind of holding its breath about what might happen. Could you talk about what exactly Russia and Iran in particular, we can begin, and then of course bring in China, but you had so much important information for people to understand and know about this burgeoning relationship and how it relates to what Israel is doing. And really now a lot of these recent moves are a response to Israel. That's pretty massive, and I think is not getting enough attention. So Pepe, to you.
I'm sure in the US is not getting attention at all. All of us who follow American mainstream media, of course. First of all, because they don't understand the character of the interlocking strategic partnerships, Russia, China, Iran. They simply don't get it. And even the think tanks don't get it. Well, China, let's say, oversimplifying, of course, China is more or less on the backyard, in the diplomatic front. They are explicitly saying that they support Palestine. They explicitly acknowledge over the phone Wang Yi and the acting Iranian foreign minister Ali Bagherikani, excellent diplomat. They had a phone call a week ago, and basically Wang Yi said, look, whatever you decide in your response to what Israel did in terms of assassinate Haniyeh in Tehran, you know, we got your back. This is enormous, and it's part of their strategic relationship, which is energy. It has military components as well, geopolitically, of course. The fact that Iran wanted to bring wanted to bring Iran into BRICS for a long time, etc. Iran at the SCO, etc. So let's say this is a Chinese SCO angle of supporting whatever Iran does in West Asia. Russia is much more complex because their strategic partnership militarily is very, very advanced. Basically, Shoigu went to Tehran two weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, basically to accelerate the signing of their overall strategic partnership, including military, ultra high level military exchanges. Of course, all those Antonov cargo planes landing in Iran a few days ago, carrying a lot of stuff, including practically certain, of course, no smoking gun from either side because this is mega top secret. Certainly, the Murmansk BN jamming those 35 meter high towers capable of jamming everything anywhere at a range of 5,000 kilometers. So the Russians certainly provide Iran with that. So in terms of bolstering Iran's aerial defenses, this is absolutely priceless. And maybe some extra hypersonic Mr. Sarmat and Mr. King Zhao kind of deal that we don't know about, but quite possible. Considering that Iran, they have their own hypersonic missiles, but not as advanced as the Russian missiles. And of course, the fact that Russia continues to buy the tons, in fact, tens of thousands of Shahid drones from Iran. So Iran said, okay, we're going to need this, 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 and this for our response. And the Russians said, oh, yeah, of course. Basically, what I heard last year in Moscow when an Iranian delegation was visiting Moscow, and they said, look, the dialogue was fantastic. Basically, we told the Russians, anything you want, just ask, and vice versa. And obviously, for the response, the way this is being organized between Khamenei, the IRGC, and other focuses, nodes of the axis of resistance, they're going to need a Russian military help. Of course, this has to remain secret because Russia has a tremendous problem when it comes to Israel. Focus it on the 1 million plus Russian passport holders or double passport holders who live in Israel. This is a very, very complicated affair because according to the Russian constitution, Russia has to protect them. The fact that many of these are hardcore Zionists and with a genocidal mentality makes the problem even more unsolvable. But Russia has to deal with that as well. So whichever way they choose to help Iran, it has to be extremely carefully calculated, as carefully calculated as the Iranian and acts of resistance response to the assassination of Shukr in Beirut and Haniyeh in Tehran. The Iranians are not in a hurry. I had this conversation these past few days. They are not in a hurry at all. They already said, look, we might not do anything if there is a plausible, serious ceasefire in Gaza. For the moment, it's not credible. There is the possibility of a ceasefire that Hamas already said, no, we don't agree, because Netanyahu all the time is blocking some sort of resolution. So this is the only conditions that Iran said that they would not retaliate. So they will retaliate, but it can be, it won't be like we imagine. It would not be in the first few days and weeks, and they could postpone it to September, or even to late September, or even to a few days before the BRICS summit. And anything is possible because the initiative is with Iran, and they choose what they're going to do, how they're going to respond, how deep, how complex, what they can, what kind of installations they want to target. So they have the initiative. And of course, they have this support in the back by Russia and China at different levels, geoeconomic, geopolitical, and diplomatic, is already assured. So this would be basically a BRICS SCO operation. For all practical purposes, Iran will be responding from the point of view of BRICS and SCO to a branch of the forever wars complex in Israel, what they are doing genocidically in Gaza. So this is very, very serious. This is a direct clash between the title of my latest book, Eurasia Against NATO-STAN. This is a chapter of Eurasia Against NATO-STAN in practice, in front of us, in front of the whole world to see, you know. So this requires very careful preparation. It will happen, but it will happen on Iran's terms. And then obviously, Danny and all of you, all bets are off, because then there will be the counter response by Israel, and anything is possible, including a nuclear response. Kiev style.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I think those are the stakes, Pepe. And you know, it was so interesting. One of the reasons why your article is so critical is because it goes over the series of events so important. I mean, Sergei Shoigu was in Tehran very quickly. I mean, very yes. quickly to not only discuss what might happen in terms of Iran's retaliation, but also to discuss military to military partnership, the military relations, sewing up on both sides. What kind of military armaments they're going to be trading essentially with each other. And then, of course, you had this very important meeting, too, that you mentioned with Mr. Abbas, the not so legitimate president of the Palestinian Authority. But nonetheless, you said hours long worth of conversation with Vladimir Putin himself.
True.
And this comes after the Beijing Declaration, which Russia also helped engineer with China. It was brokered in China, but the Beijing Declaration, both Russia and China have been working so hard with Palestinian leadership around how to develop this kind of new unity government. So talk about how these developments also fit into this larger, as you said, BRICS-supported, BRICS-aligned support for what Iran and, of course, the rest of the axis of resistance may do from here and into the future.
Well, the Chinese, Danny, they took the assassination of Han Ye as a personal affront, as a diplomatic slap on their faces. You cannot do this in Asia and get away with it. All of us who have lived in Asia for decades, we know this on an everyday basis. You know, these are the basic rules of life and interaction across Asia. You cannot have your interlocutor lose face in such a manner or basically insult him in front of the whole world. Only a few days after Han Ye was one of the representatives of 14 different Palestinian factions coming to Beijing, invited by the Chinese, signing the Beijing Declaration with Wang Yi putting the Chinese stamp of approval and support to the declaration, the Israelis kill the main negotiator of a ceasefire in Gaza. Well, I could take days explaining to all of you precedents in the Chinese diplomatic history to what happens to people who try to pull something of that caliber. And if Genghis Khan or Genghis Khan's heirs were still active in Asia, the response would be a pyramid of schools in Israel, you know, at least. But okay, we're not there yet. But this was taken by the Chinese as a personal affront. So that's why they are even more implicated in diplomatic Chinese style, supporting everything concerning Palestine, Palestinian unity, Palestinian efforts, and of course the Iranian response to what Israelis did with the assassination of Ani. And of course, Russia and China, they discuss this among them. And of course, they discuss with the Iranian leadership as well. We can, of course, it's not practically established, but those phone calls between Wang Yi and Lavrov, now they involve the acting Iranian foreign minister, Ali Bagheri Khan. They already appointed Agachi as a new, but was not confirmed by parliament yet. So for the moment, the top diplomat in Iran, a negotiator of very, very serious stuff, is Bagheri Khan, extremely competent. And I'm sure they are talking, he's talking to Lavrov and Wang Yi, you know, full time. Absolutely full time. Just like Lavrov and Wang Yi talk full time about Southeast Asia, for instance. Late last month, they were here at the summit in Laos, the East Asian summit, and they had a bilateral that lasted practically half a day discussing Southeast Asia. They discussed West Asia on practically on a daily basis as well. But the thing is how to calibrate this response to a point where they're not, the counter response by Israel not only will bleed Iran, but could bleed Russia and China in several ways, you know, further on down the road or immediately. So that's the complication. And we can more or less understand that from the point of view of this BRICS trio, a response by Iran before the BRICS summit would be essential, because this will go to the BRICS summit and be presented to the other BRICS and to the countries that are invited as observers and as part of the mechanism called BRICS Outreach in Kazan in October. The top BRICS can explain to all of them, look, this is the stakes that we are all facing, because the war on the other side is a war against all of us. It's a war against BRICS. It's a war against Eurasian integration. It's a war against BRICS. It's a war against the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's a war against the Eurasia Economic Union. It's a war against the Belt and Road Initiative, corridors of trade and communication. It's a war against the international north-south transportation corridor, Russia, Iran, and India. So it's a war against Eurasia as a whole. And of course, the other BRICS will, I would not put Brazil into it, because Brazil is now in such a pathetic foreign policy condition. I prefer not even to talk about it.
The disappointment of Lula da Silva supporting new elections in Venezuela is certainly ringing very loud in my head.
Very loud in your head. I prefer not even talk about that, because sure. I could derail and go too hardcore.
That's not, yeah.
But people who read my telegrams and the people that I quote from Brazil in my telegrams, they know exactly what I'm talking about, right? Well, I'll have a chance to see it by myself in November. I'm going to the G20 in Rio in November. So then I'll have the big local picture about of that. But basically, to all of you, one information is enough. I'm sure you remember, we have discussed this here in the past. The famous visit by Jake Sullivan to Brazil before Lula was elected with a list. So Lula has to follow the list. If he doesn't, he's toast, and he knows it. So this is very, very sad. This is very, very sad, because there's no sovereignty involved. So Brazil is not a sovereign country at the moment. Unfortunately, it pains me deeply to acknowledge that, but these are the facts, right? Well, what can be presented to the BRICS as a whole and to the BRICS guests in October could be something construed as a BRICS response to what Israel is doing against Iran and even against Palestine. And very important, all of you, guess who's going to be one of the guests of the BRICS summit in this outreach mode? Palestine. So Palestine will be in Kazan in October, sitting on the same table with all the BRICS and all the BRICS guests. So this tells you everything you need to know about who's supporting whom.
Yes, yes, indeed. So Pepe, I wanted to also just briefly before we move on, you know, everything you were saying is so interesting to note, because not only, I mean, we've seen it with Ukraine, we've seen Zelensky get the very cold shoulder from this, in particular, this BRICS trio, Russia, of course, but China and Iran as well. But we're also seeing it, I believe, also with Israel, because as you're talking about all these developments, what came up in my mind was Netanyahu has not been to Beijing, has not been to Moscow. There has been with either Russia or China. So your final words on this before we move on.
Well, look, it's very important to remember that China and Israel do a lot of business. So, but at the moment, everything is on hold, especially after this slap in the Chinese face, the Haniyeh assassination. So I'm sure that the Chinese are obviously you won't read that in Chinese media. These are decisions at the highest level, and they are strategic decisions, very, very serious. But China is certainly reevaluating their business relations with Israel. There's no question about that. And they are paying attention to their relations with the Arab world as a whole and to all the lands of Islam, which are much more important for China as we can say self-described leader of the global South. They consider themselves, China doesn't consider itself a developed country. It considers itself a developing country, leader of the, one of the leaders of the global South. And obviously, when you think about 1.8 at least a billion Muslims all over the world, China is looking at the lands of Islam as partners, as supporters, as diplomatic partners and supporters, and as trade partners as well. Very, very important. And of course, in terms of solidifying the global presence of China as a first-rate diplomatic, conciliatory, geopolitical play. So obviously in this hurricane, let's put it this way, that thing swirling around inside the hurricane Israel, they are seriously reconsidering their relations with Israel. And Russia, like we said a few minutes ago, it's much more complicated because of this 1 million plus Russian Russophones, Russian speakers, Russian passport holders, or double passport holders. And Russia simply cannot abandon them in the middle of genocide land. So for both of these actors, the challenges are very different, although the decisions, the strategic decisions at the highest level are taking in tandem, of course, but they have to look around for, you know, variations, demultiplying problems. We can expect from the Chinese a much more forceful position regarding the genocide and regarding Palestine, because now they are directly implicated. Now they have their name in the signature with the Beijing Declaration. It's their responsibility, you know, so it's much more active. Until a month ago was not like that. So this is a game changer in a sense.
Thank you for tuning in to my latest video. I appreciate all of your support. This channel, however, needs your help. I am seeking to make this channel more sustainable in the long term and upgrade necessary equipment to ensure that this work continues onward and makes progress to give you all of the geopolitical analysis that you all deserve. For that reason, I'm asking you to become a member of my Patreon community at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. You can find that link in the video description or in the pinned comment below. For whatever amount you choose to give, just know you are supporting independent media that you can't find anywhere else. Thank you so much, and I look forward to the next video.
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults. with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, September 4th. Here are some headlines. After one of the hottest summers on record, many cities across California and the desert Southwest are coping with a dangerous heat wave this week. Excessive heat warnings are in effect today through Friday across much of Southern California into far Southern Nevada and Southwest. In some areas, a strong heat dome could send temperatures soaring as high as 115 degrees. The heat should gradually ease this weekend as the high pressure heat dome slowly drifts east. Excessive heat can cause heat-related illness with the elderly, young children, and outdoor workers at the greatest risk. Climate change is intensifying heat waves while also raising their likelihood and duration. In political news, Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris is in New Hampshire today to announce a plan to expand tax credits for small businesses. Harris is scheduled to campaign outside Portsmouth at a brewery that received a tax credit and installed solar panels with support from a Biden administration program. Harris's new tax proposal calls for credits of up to $50,000 for startup expenses, with a goal of incentivizing 25 million new small business applications over 4 years. The trip to New Hampshire is unusual for Harris at this point in her campaign, which has been focused on establishing a presence in large battleground states, including Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Georgia. Harris spent her Labor Day in Detroit and Pittsburgh and is returning to Pittsburgh tomorrow. A federal judge yesterday denied former President Donald Trump's request to move his New York hush money case to federal court. Trump is due to be sentenced later this month in the case in which he was found guilty on all 34 counts of falsifying business records to conceal payments to Stormy Daniels. Trump hoped to move the case to federal court so that he could seek to have his conviction overturned in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that presidents have immunity for official acts taken while in office. In his ruling yesterday, Judge Alvin Hellerstein found there is nothing in the Supreme Court's ruling that changes the fact that the Trump payments to Daniels were private, unofficial acts. Moving the case to federal court would have also likely delayed sentencing until after the election. In international news, another round of Russian airstrikes killed 7 people in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv early today, a day after one of the deadliest missile attacks of the war killed at least 53 people and wounded more than 200 others. Yesterday's strike hit a military academy and hospital in the central eastern city of Poltava, between the capital, Kyiv, and Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, near the Russian border. And today, Ukraine's foreign minister, submitted his resignation as part of a cabinet reshuffle announced by President Zelensky last week. Four other ministers also submitted resignations late yesterday. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.